This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sumitra Selvaraj. Now, social activists carry the weight of the world on their shoulders, it would seem, and I don't mean that in a flippant manner at all. They take on causes that most of us only discuss fleetingly and dedicate their lives to effecting change. They put the cause before themselves, as it were. But what happens when social activists burn out? What happens when that one person who shoulders a cause starts to falter? Dr. Sudeep Mohandas from iFairs International and Hayati Ismail join me here today to share their insights into why social activists need to put self-care at the top of their to-do lists. Thank you both for being here today. Perhaps we can start with you both letting us know what your current roles and work responsibilities are. Sudeep, we'll start with you.
Sure. Thank you, Sumitra. So what I do really is about trying to professionalize the NGOs or the purpose-based organizations. And what that means is many of the issues actually stem at the management and board level.
Mm-hmm.
And we always find that although we actually focus on the activities on the ground, many of the decisions or many of the elements that even when it comes to burnout or for that matter, when people get stressed out and have some mental incapacity, it happens because of how the boards and management manage.
And that trickles down then to the actual operations and how the, well, how the cause is even perceived in the public eye, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yati?
Currently, I'm fundraising for two NGOs.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Cheshire Home and also Malaysian Rare Disease.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they need help in fundraising and making sure that, you know, the cause is served so that they can reach more beneficiary.
Okay. But in the past, the both of you have been in fairly, I would say, major roles when it comes to social activism. Hayati, you used to head up the Food Aid Foundation. Perhaps you could start off by telling us about your days there.
Okay. As you know, I started with Free Market, and then comes My Street Interview, Suspended Meal before I joined Food Aid Foundation. Then I was there for 4.5 years.
In the capacity of?
Capacity of the Director of Operations. I love my job.
Mm.
I think the mistake I made was I do it out of passion. So when you do it out of passion, sometimes, of course, you get burnt out. But being a social activist, you tend to deny it. But it's actually eating you every day.
So let's dial it back a little bit. When you worked with the Food Aid Foundation and your director of operations there, what did a typical day look like for you? When did it start? What were your responsibilities?
Okay, first of all, I must make sure in the morning that my driver goes out.
What time does your day start?
As early as 9 a.m.
Okay.
But we practice 9 to 5, of course, but things go sometime beyond 5 p.m. and earlier than 9 a.m.
Yeah.
But a normal typical day starts with me going in and making sure the operations run smooth.
Mm-hmm.
The drivers goes out on time to do their collection and delivery.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the office, I make sure that, you know, I take care of the administration as well and do fun, and I write papers on fundraising for grants. So that's my everyday job.
And did your work take you through the weekends as well?
Yes, because usually events are on weekends. You know, the clients wants to do events on weekends because they're not working on weekends. So
sure.
Most Saturdays are taken up. And then sometimes when I need to travel outside KL, so especially in the States where they work on Sunday, so Sunday is a working day as well for me. Sometimes I work 7 days a week for months.
And Sudeep, you were in a major role with the WWF Malaysia. Perhaps you could tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I started with them in 1999. And at that time, I joined them as the HR manager. I do recall at that time, times were very different with WWF. And but I moved up over the time, and I spent about 13 years with them and moved up a rank and file up to the chief operating officer. I think the experience and the knowledge I had at the time is many times I came to a point where I lost my mojo.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a telling that perhaps I'm actually hitting a burnout at some point. But it was good because at that time there was opportunity to rise and take on new responsibilities. And I was there at the right time.
So I want to go into this whole idea of burnout and what you mentioned earlier, Yati, about having made a mistake because you did this job for passion. I want to get into that a little bit later. But first of all, I want to check with you. When you worked your jobs in social enterprises and with social activism, did you expect your colleagues to have the same amount of enthusiasm and drive that you did?
Of course you do, but unfortunately, no. Because it's a different when people have passion towards their job and people who comes in just to have a job.
Mm.
So you don't get, you know, so that's why you are not on the same wavelength with your colleagues sometimes. And doing it out of passion, you always feel guilty if you don't, something is not done.
Mm.
So you end up, you know, taking over their job. But it's not a right way to do. You know it's not right, but you just have to get it done because you don't want to disappoint anyone.
So Deb, is it possible that everybody who works in a social enterprise or a social or in an NGO has the same amount of commitment because they are working for the greater good?
There's a saying when you receive your job description on the first day, that's as how long it'll go. Your job description only lasts you for a day. After that, it all depends on basically how things work. And so I think that going back to your point, whether it really everybody's on the same page with you, that varies. That definitely varies. And you can see that basically in terms of how they ask questions, how they participate.
So that's what I was going to ask you. Because you both come from an operations background, and Sudip, especially because you come from an HR background as well, is there a certain type of person who works well within social activism or within an NGO?
I certainly think so. I mean, there must be some elements and that you bring it. But having said that, I have seen people who come in with none of those and then suddenly transform and become that.
Okay, so what are some of these values that you're looking for?
Well, I think first of all is the wanting to learn. Mm-hmm. That's a very key point. And willing to change. Mm-hmm. I think those are the two elements that are very key, because at the end of the day, if you're wanting to learn, you tend to ask questions and you tend to go take the extra mile in moving forward. Willing to change, meaning that you look, reflect on yourself and you realize whether you adapt and you can align and all that. And so you make sure you fit with the whole system itself. And I think those two become very important.
Mm.
And they set your behaviors as well.
I understand that flexibility that you mean, it has to be internal. Yati, in the course of your work, have you been able to kind of instantly tell whether somebody is suited for NGO work or not?
I think over the years, yes, I do. Because they need to have interest in what they're doing. They need to believe in the cause. You know, no matter what NGO they are with, whatever cause they are doing, they have to understand why they are there, what they are doing, and how they are there to improve what they are doing.
Okay, so this whole thing about they have to understand why they are there, right? Should they not have understood that before taking on a job in an NGO?
Okay, I would say maybe Dr. Sudip has got more experience, but I'm looking at the younger generation.
Okay.
They're there just because they need a job.
To a large extent, that may be true. But again, it depends on where you're coming from. Because at the end of the day, those who have already got a job, and they may be young, I think Hayati probably we can define the young, but I think if they already have a job and they want to join a cause, you'll find that most of the time when they leave a job and they join something of a cause, they set some expectations.
Right.
And those expectations actually come from a certain framework that how things should be. And that's where things become a bit difficult, because it doesn't fit into it. And that's where, you know, all the issues start to rise and all that.
Okay. I want to get into that a little bit more, but we're going to take a short break first. I'm speaking to Dr. Sudip Mohandas from IFES International and Hayati Ismail about some of the challenges of throwing yourself wholeheartedly into social causes and the possibility of burnout. We're going to take a short break. As I mentioned earlier, you're listening to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Sumitra Selvaraj. I'm speaking to Dr. Sudip Mohandas from IFES International and Hayati Ismail about what happens when people take on social causes and start feeling overwhelmed by their workload. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about when young people come into social enterprises, perhaps not quite fully understanding what they're getting into. What are the realities of working in social causes, Sudip?
Yeah, Your question actually jogs a story in my mind, and that's basically what actually happened. And I do recall what happened was one particular person wanted to join WWF, and at that time she had this dream that it was something like National Geographic or Discovery. You'd be there, and
so, you know, glamorous.
Yes. Well, she had, that was a dream, and most cases get because of the brand. And she joined, and when we gave her the letter of offer, she was really happy and enthralled. 6 months down the road, she resigned, and it was a whole different picture. And when we did an exit interview and we asked her, it had nothing to do with the activities that we were doing on the ground. It had nothing to do with the issues that were WWF was involved in. It was more of the internal elements that were driving her in the wrong direction. It was how management was. Mm-hmm. It was how the decisions were made, and it was how the culture was. And this happens in any organization.
I was just going to say, I dare say that this is part and parcel of working anywhere.
Exactly.
Why should it be more idealistic just because it's for a cause?
Well, this is the question. I still wonder why, but most people have this thinking that if you're going to heaven, you should get everything there. There should not be nothing about hell there. Everything should be. So I think it's that kind of thinking, you know.
It right.
should be 100% perfect. Well, it's not that way. It doesn't work that way, you know.
Ayati, did you know exactly what you were getting yourself into when you joined the Food Aid Foundation? Or I should really say started up the Food Aid Foundation.
No, I don't. No, I know it was a food bank. So I didn't know anything about food bank. I just know how to eat. That's me. Mm-hmm. So when I joined them, then I knew that I have to learn a lot of things. So mm-hmm. I did a lot of reading for the first 6 months mm-hmm. to understand what is food bank. I do my own research. That's how I grow Food Aid Foundation. Mm-hmm. So it may not be on the same book with others, my thinking, but I noticed that it's a learning process because food bank is something new in Malaysia, and how you can make it better. Mm. But it's the challenges. So everybody thinks like, you know, joining an NGO is something like, you know, a relaxed job. Then you can just go and see people. You know, people get the wrong impression of what your work as a social worker is.
So what is the reality? And you can give me the reality specifically from the Food Aid Foundation point of view, because you were there on the ground.
Yeah, because I think when I was working in corporate or when I was working in Food Aid Foundation, it's the same. So I come up with a conclusion. NGO is just like corporate, except we are non-profit. Mm. So there's nothing, no discount, no nothing. So it's just like, you know, people who comes in. Yeah, I do get, you know, people who join and then left after 3 months, 2 months, 6 months, because they couldn't take it. Because especially these youngsters, when they join NGO, they think, oh, it's a nice place to work. You can help people. But they don't know where the reality is. It's the same everywhere.
So if an NGO is exactly the same as a corporate, but without the profit, all that means is that money becomes the greatest stress. Would that be fair to say, Sadiq?
Not necessarily so. I would say that, yes, money is a big issue, and perhaps how it is managed. For example, some NGOs don't give bonuses. Increments may be a bit of a challenge. Mm-hmm. Benefits become an issue sometimes. But there are other elements that benefit an NGO. I mean, you could actually have the flexibility, the working from home elements, your work-life balance could be there, you know, depending on how it is. The kind of warmth and culture of working for a cause and, you know, getting your family involved sometimes in whatever you do. Mm. So those things are where, you know, it really benefits an NGO. And I think that's the balance that people have to see, where what outweighs the other. So I would think that that's how it goes.
Okay. Let's go into a little bit about, since we were talking about money earlier on, maybe to look at this idea of, as you mentioned, funding within an NGO. And an area that is of particular interest to me, which is how people who work in social enterprises are valued for their time and contribution, and basically how they're paid. I know you're a very strong proponent of this, Sudeep. You believe that, you know, you must be paid first, and you must be paid well in order to do a job, whether it's corporate or non-profit. Perhaps you could share your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I always put this case forward to a lot of people. I mean, if you're really doing, if I may say, work for people and planet, which is actually the beneficiaries is everybody, mm-hmm. then really you should be paid a lot more than somebody who's going to rape the land or make life difficult for everyone. Mm-hmm. I think that's where my argument comes from. I mean, if you're doing so-called, if I say, God's work, then you should be paid well. You should be given the benefits and you shouldn't be questioned so much because you're actually working really hard for it. But it doesn't work that way. It's kind of an irony or some kind of hypocritical aspect to how things are run.
You know this all too well, right, Hayati?
Yes. You know, just like I'm sharing, it's like, you know, we all are doing a course. Just like, you know, the Imam, the Bilal of a mosque is being paid.
Yes.
You know, they're not there for free.
No, but they're also doing a work for a cause and for a good cause.
So nobody questioned them, but why are you questioning us, the NGOs, if we get little extra? But that's the thing. In Malaysia, compared to Thailand, we are very... We are paid very, very low. So, you know, we have people, we have, you know, bills to pay. And then we move from one place to another. We you know, we need to fill petrol in our car. Then we have children that needs to go to school. So what? Why are they treating us differently?
Sudip, is it possible that, you know, this sort of undervaluing of people, personnel who work within the NGO sphere is a potential reason why burnout does occur?
To some extent, because there are a lot of environmental factors that come in as well, not just internally when at your work. I mean, at the point of many people joining an NGO or a social enterprise, depending on how it is, at the parents' side, there may be elements of societal recognition and how you're accepted. So they walk around with something looming over their head. You know, why are you doing? So they get that kind of stress. And then when they're working on it, not everything works out. People tend to, so they have this impression that if you're working for NGO, that means you have tons of money in the bank. Perhaps that's why you're doing
because
some volunteer.
Because you can afford,
to work in an NGO.
Yeah.
You know, or you basically are somebody who's never got, not been able to get a corporate job. That's why you're working for an NGO. So a lot of misnomers about why people are working, and that adds to why they are, besides the internal elements of their struggle and their ability to raise funds and get money, because a lot of them who do raise funds are trying to raise funds for their own salary, which is a little different. Okay, so many actually have to work for projects and get that money because it also pays for their salary, and that adds to their stress.
Right, right. Hayati, have you ever? Oh no, no, it's not fair for me to say. Have you ever felt overwhelmed? I know you have felt overwhelmed over the years. Could you maybe help us understand what being overwhelmed feels like?
You're happy every time you help people. But people don't understand that it is also draining, because when you go down at the, on the ground, you know, the cases you get actually drain you. So you are overwhelmed, at the same time you are drained. So that is, that causes the burnout. Because, you know, you have to see things that you don't want to see. Like, you know, people who's really, really poor, has nothing to eat. And you cannot cry in front of them because you're a social worker. Not because you're a social worker, but if you cry in front of them, you are not strong anymore. So you wanted to give everything in your bank account to them.
But you can't.
But you can't, because you are limited by a lot of things, a lot of factors. You are working with someone. So, you know, you can only help them to a certain extent. And then when you go back at night, you can't sleep. You feel so bad.
What do you say to yourself to get through the really, really hard days?
You know, I would always, you know, console myself and say, you know, you've done your best. So maybe you can just reach out to others who can help the family, or, you know, the people who's in need. So that is what I have to tell myself that every day, because I want to help a lot of people.
And this, to me, Sudip, right, is honest a statement as you're going to get. I know the work Hayati does, and I've seen the effect of her work. And yet, despite doing so much good, she feels the burden of not having done enough. And yet there are still people who will sit back and look at people who work in social causes and say, you're not doing enough.
Absolutely.
Why?
Absolutely.
Why? What gives people the right to do that?
Because people, every time they don't see the bar has been raised with their work. They just see the bar as it is. They don't realize that little bit of effort has made a significance to one individual. For them, it's perhaps the hundreds. And the other thing is, a lot of success stories don't get heard. A lot of them, like, for example, Hayati has done a lot of work. I'm sure it's not heard enough. So this becomes the issue. Everyone thinks that, you know, it's just not enough. And it's inbuilt in their own system. And how they, there's a saying that says that, you know, whatever you do or wherever you go, you're still there.
Mm. Oh, I like that. I like that. Okay. So, Hayati, when you were taking on so many different responsibilities, right? I'm sure, and I don't want to overstep here, but I have a feeling that there might have been a sense of guilt that other aspects of your life were not being as paid as much attention as you would have liked.
Yeah, I miss my son's concert. I miss taking their report cards, you know, because of job. Because I'm always somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I feel kind of bad because, you know, then I always send my sister to go to the concert and pick up my children's report card, which is not the right thing to do. But, you know, having said that, that is why I was soul searching for a month during Ramadan. And then I said to myself, I think I have to put a stop to it because I think this is not leading me to any healthier life. And I'm not going to contribute more sitting here on this chair comfortably. Fame is one thing. Fame will never take you anywhere. It's just there. And, you know, 20 years down the road, people will forget about you.
When you were taking that time for yourself, what were some of the things that you focused on?
I was soul searching, trying to understand myself. You know, I did what I do because the passion of helping people. But, you know, there's a lot of other way that I can help people. So I went for an NLP course. So during that NLP course, I managed to see that what I did was wrong.
And why would you say what you did was wrong?
Because I was not balancing them. You know, I do it out of passion. I don't care. You know, my job is first, my family is second, which is wrong. It should be me first and second, the work that I do, the course that I do. It's like, you know, putting an oxygen first on you before putting it to your child. So it the same concept must apply in your life. So it goes the other way around. So it's very, very wrong. So my children are growing up. I don't want to miss another thing about them.
This is Hayati's, of course, real life experience. But Sudeep, you teach this regularly to people who work in social enterprises as well, don't you?
Yeah, and I profess for the fact that this issue of not separating work and home is those days is gone. We should actually have people bring work home and bring home to work.
Nice.
Because at the end of the day, this integration is what is going to keep the equilibrium. If I have issues at home, I should be allowed to bring it at work and talk about it because that is my opening, my way of getting into my comfort zone, letting people understand where my issues are. Same way when I go back to home, I should be able to talk about work, let my family get to know what my difficulties are, my issues are, and we work it out. I mean, just think about it. When children were in school, you normally ask, what did the child do in school?
Yes.
Right? You don't say, oh, that's your school. I don't want to know. And this is my home. We don't talk about it. No, we mix it up. And that's how you get this kind of feeling. The thing is, we've actually separated them. And so we don't get this integration. And people come back thinking they're two different worlds. And when the moment they're two different worlds, then that's where the issues start. But if you can integrate them, then they can become one and things can accommodate. Companies can get more performance. And at home, you can be much more happier.
Mm. Hayati, you mentioned earlier when things were getting really, really busy for you, you know, your sister very kindly stepped in and helped out. Besides your sister, who was your support system?
My husband. So they take charge of, getting the children to school, sending them for, you know, the exams and everything. So, but mommy is always not there. Mm. So, I get, like Dr. Sudeep said, I get to speak about my work at home. So sometimes I discuss with my family, you know, and then sometimes my father lives with me. So I think I'm taking care of him. He's 82 years old. So sometimes he said to me, you work too hard. You know, you think of other people too much that you're forgetting your role in this house. Mm. Then it hits me so many times when he said that.
It's a hard thing to hear.
Of course, my husband won't say that to me. Mm. But my father, you know.
And it's a hard thing to hear from a parent, right?
From a parent, it's just like, you say, why do you have to work so hard for others? You know, I know you like to help people, but you have to help your family first.
Sudeep, could you help me with understand something? let's say you have a couple, a married couple, and, you know, they've been married, you know, for many years, let's say 10 years. And maybe after the 10th year or so, one of the two, maybe either the husband or the wife, suddenly discovers a cause and suddenly discovers that this is something that they want to dedicate their life to. And the relationship changes because the other partner doesn't quite understand, how is this person whom I met, fell in love with and married suddenly changed so dramatically? How do people come to terms when something else enters the marriage?
And this happens all the time. And I'll tell you this. If it actually does happen, then the remedy of this not happening in anyone else's life, it is to make sure that conversation about what you're feeling at work, have that conversation all the time, because then it won't be a surprise 10 years later.
Okay.
I think that issue is not having. That's why I said, you got to mix work and home. Then you know the evolution. You know how things have moved towards this.
Mm-hmm.
It happened to me. I mean, I moved out of an NGO, now doing things for an NGO.
Mm-hmm.
If I had kept quiet and never brought it home to my wife, and it would have been such a surprise. Why do you want to leave? Why do you want to start something very different?
Mm.
So I think that conversation has to happen. The secondly is, when it does happen,
well,
what do you do? I think the issue is then that conversation about, say, come and see my world. Come and see what I'm going to do is very important. I think that's where I can come forward and tell.
Okay, so let's go back to something Hayati did, which I think is very, very brave. When you sensed that you were approaching burnout, you stepped back and you took a break.
Yes.
How did you know that you were approaching burnout?
The signs are everywhere. You can see that, you know, you're not healthy anymore. Your weight starts, you start gaining weight. That's not a good sign, actually. Then at one time, you're just losing weight. So you see, there's a fluctuation of, you know, you're going up and down like a yo-yo.
Mm.
So one thing I know is like, something is imbalanced in you.
Mm.
And then you'd have sleepless night. No, I can't really sleep well at night. So I end up going for, you know, yoga and going for acupuncture. It's not helping. So until I said, you know, it's time for me to stop and be brave and just step back, because I know, if I want to do good, I can do it in many, many ways.
Mm.
Just not being here won't kill me, won't kill anyone. But I think we need to create something. I need to be fair to myself.
Mm. But as we know, Sudeep, when social activists do take a break, and it is a very well-deserved break as well, there is immediate judgment that they are not being committed to their cause. How do we change this perception?
And this goes back to what I mentioned earlier about at the management and board level. I mean, there must be a system inbuilt whereby if you have spent so many hours, if in a social cause a year, you deserve a sabbatical, you deserve a timeout.
Mm-hmm.
If you've been already gone through, I mean, you see this in the police, you see this in the army, you see this in basically people who are actually in the issues where it really happens.
Mm.
They have time out.
Mm.
And it's because they actually have an equation or a measure to see it. It's not there in the NGOs enough to say, okay, it's time out. Why? Well, it's simply because there's either resources, there's too much work, there's no time to give out. You have the best people with you, you can't let go. So there's a chicken and egg. But I would say, I always tell people at the board, it's either you wait for them to get burned out or you wait for them to get burnt, toasted. I mean, the moment an egg becomes boiled, it can't go back to being half boiled or not boiled. So you got to be prepared for that, in which case then you need a system straight away.
Okay. So what would some of your top advice be, or top tips be, to prevent burnout in social activists?
I think immediate interventions. That means there must be counselors involved, psychologists involved. And today we're talking a lot about mental health issues that has to be addressed. Having that is not a wrong. It's actually a good thing. People in-house to actually do this, to actually ask questions. When you do your performance appraisals, add this. Counseling, a bit of psychology into those things. Have that as a part of it. So people know, not just in terms of whether you met your objectives, whether your mental state of mind is also going with the times.
Right.
We tend to separate it out. And I think that's very key. And we'll know what's the before and after, because So that's where I will go.
Okay. And Hayati, as somebody who has approached burnout, come to the brink of it, and in my eyes, very successfully pulled herself away from it, could we have some of your top tips on what we can do to, what social activists can do to prevent burnout?
Okay, one, I agree. We need to go on sabbatical. We cannot be working and working and working. I think every 2 years, you need to let go your stuff, like at least 3 months for sabbatical. Don't worry, the job will still run, your course will still run. So all the founders, the board of the council members, board of directors, do give a break to your employee because certain external things may also affect their life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. And number two, I think NGOs should start sending their staff for training.
Mm.
You cannot just be doing the work because you think you're good at it.
Mm.
Because they need to go for like motivational skill, time management, or you know, any other course that is suitable to what the course they're doing. Because if that is the way, one way you empower your people.
Mm.
So you know, being an NGO, you're like a family there.
You're right.
So you need to hold each other's hand. You need to make sure you empower them so that you know the course can be bigger.
Right.
A lot of people don't see that.
Yeah, I dare say we should send them to Sudeep.
Oh dear.
Yes, I was like talking to Dr. Sudeep. I said, yeah, we NGO should go to you because that is what I see in NGO line.
Okay, so I want to wrap up this interview with a question that doesn't only apply to social activists, but to everybody, right? We've been talking a lot today about work-life integration, not balance, work-life integration. But many people are unable to even think about how to, as you mentioned earlier, Sudeep, how to separate, let alone how to start work-life integration. Is there something that we could do to just begin to try work-life integration?
Yeah, I guess from where I look at it, I think the first thing is start it from home. Okay. Everyone at home, start talking about your work. Take a 5 minutes and say, ask questions where it's rhetoric, and or ask questions that are a little bit hard. Like, for example, my dear wife, do you know much about my work? Or my dear husband, how much do you know what I'm doing in the office?
Do you know who irritated me today?
Exactly. Yeah. Who am I in there? Who's the Sith? You know, mm-hmm. That kind of stuff. Let's just see how much they do know. And then you know, okay, this is how much they know. Let's move forward. Let's have a conversation. At the same time, do it at work. I mean, how much do your friends really know you at work, at home? What kind of person?
Hayati, top tips for work-life integration, successful work-life integration.
It's something that I practice at home and don't practice at work. You know, I always ask my children. That's a habit I always do, and ask, how's your day-to-day at school? You know, something you want to update me. But, you know, at work, it's just like everybody shut down to me because they think I'm their boss. Because I always tell them, don't ever treat me like a boss. I'm your colleague. So, you know, you are free. My door is always open. Come talk to me. But, you know, a lot of them don't speak to you, so you don't know what's their problem. And worst of all, nobody asks you whether you're okay for that day. You know, not every day we are okay. So it works everywhere. So even if you're in the office, I advise that, you know, if you're an employer, speak to your employee and ask them how's their day.
Thank you both for making my day. I really appreciate the insights that you've shared with me. I've been speaking to Dr. Sudeep Mohan Das from IFES International and tireless social activist Hayati Ismail about burnout in social activists and how to keep it at bay. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn segments, you can download the podcasts on our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.